Wade Davis has spent a lifetime learning from the indigenous peoples of the world. In 2009, Wade delivered the CBC Massey Lectures, The Wayfinders. The subtitle was, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World. And that pretty much sums up Wade Davis. He believes that the future and the present of humanity depends on listening to indigenous peoples, to what they know of the world, to what they have to teach us, and how they can help our species both survive and thrive. These days, Wade Davis teaches anthropology at the University of British Columbia. But he's barely slowed down from his days of being chased across the mountains of Colombia by the revolutionary FARC. He's still explorer-in-residence at the National Geographic Society, which may sound like a contradiction in terms. And he still travels extensively.
Where all the monkeys thrown nuts.
If I stay here, I'll go nuts.
You laid out a kind of core vision in your Massey Lectures of why ancient wisdom matters and why and how it is currently under threat. And so we're going to revisit that. You spoke in 2009, of the ethnosphere as humanity's greatest legacy. Tell us, firstly, what you meant by the ethnosphere and what's happened.
Well, what I was trying to do is create a kind of organizing principle that would draw people's attention to what was going on, to the diversity of culture brought into being by the human imagination. And, you know, we hear so much about the erosion of biological diversity, but even the most discouraged biologists would never suggest that 50% of all animal and plant life is moribund. And yet that, the most apocalyptic scenario in the realm of biological diversity, scarcely approaches what we know to be the most optimistic scenario in the realm of cultural diversity. And the key indicator of that, of course, is language loss. I mean, the fact that when all of us were born, there were 7,000 languages spoken on the planet. And by absolute academic consensus, half of those aren't being whispered today into the ears of infants.
All right, here we are in the land of the pharaohs.
Oh, no!
Well, we'll need to talk with the natives. Does anyone here know a little Egyptian?
Bill, come on. You're good at languages.
Yes, indeed. Everybody knows I'm mad. Served my every need. Did a grand job on my ankles, too.
Now, hold it right there.
Glad to. Now, I think I'll hold it over here.
Oh, boy, it's nice out, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I think you ought to leave it out.
Hey, look, fellas, fun's fun. Okay, but look, I gotta find a place to stay. It's gonna be night soon. I'm tired.
What's the matter with that dude?
I'm lost, and I want to go to bed.
Oh, my bony boy. In the Estonian mountains, we used to go to sleep leaning up against a windfall. I was but a mere prat then. I'll never forget the time a snake slithered into my wife. I wasn't but knee-high to a merry grasshopper
No, look, that's all very
never
interesting, but the
again.
Sun is going down.
Oh, no, you're all confused. The horizon is moving up.
Hey, listen, come on, you guys, help me, please.
I know. Let's stand him on his head.
Here you go.
Hey, put it down.
Easy, boy.
Ah, you see? Now it's morning.
Oh,
he's no fun. He fell right over.
Hey, won't somebody please help me?
Easy, my lad. At times of dexterity like this, my wee native compendium, Mohammed, used to pray to the divinities, his little brown froggy body a-quiver at my loins, chanting a stream of ancient Egyptian holograms.
What?
Diaphragms.
No.
I used to date...
Hieroglyphs, that's it. Do you remember any? Will they help? Anything at all?
Yes, of course. Let's see. It was a jackal-headed woman with her eyes akimbo, a king sitting sideways on his throne, a drip with gold, chipped nose uplifted. Thusly. All engraven on a pyramid of massy size, with the body of a lion, paws that refreshes, a tale told by an idiot, and the head of a fox.
Which means we're literally living through an era in which, by definition, half of humanity's intellectual, social, ecological, spiritual knowledge is at risk. And that doesn't have to happen. And what was really interesting is, I mean, this tide really strongly into my conviction that the same forces that were affecting biological diversity were, of course, affecting cultural diversity. And I'm an anthropologist. I mean, and the real purpose of anthropology, as Ruth Benedict, Franz Boas's great student, said, is to make the world safe for human differences. I mean, anthropology is the antidote to nativism. It's the antidote to Trump. You know, the real central lesson of anthropology is that every culture has something to say. Each deserves to be heard, just as none has monopoly on the route to the divine. You know, the other peoples of the world are not failed attempts at being you.
Listen, kid, I'm alone. I got the clone. Maybe we'll run into each other on the fun way, huh?
Yeah, you bet, Honky. This is Worker speaking. Hello.
Hi. Open for maintenance alignment.
What have you done?
Good. Now, let me show you something, Bozo. Detailed dress circuits.
Belt above A, below B.
Below B. Okay, close B, close mode.
Oh, my duck, his pants have disappeared. Kid, everybody's watching.
Oh, come on, now, watch this. Ego.
Go!
Close artichoke mode.
It's a rainbow. Oh, now, what happened to little Artie?
Prepare shift simulfax for hue and form. Prepare mirror clone.
What are you doing?
Clone me.
Oh, I think that's against the rules.
Legal entry.
Clone me, Dr. Memory.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm a Clem.
It's you.
No, Barney, I'm me. That's just a hologram.
They're not failed attempts at being modern. You know, every culture is a unique answer to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? And when the peoples of the world answer that question, they do so in those 7,000 different voices of humanity. And those voices and those answers collectively become our human repertoire for dealing with the challenges that will confront us in the coming centuries. And that really was the theme of the Wayfinders' Massey lectures. One of my favorite writers was Peter Mathewson, who said that anyone who thinks they can change the world is both wrong and dangerous.
I know what to do with it. Think. Slicer dicers that grow in the dark, rubber roads that lead nowhere, gas bags, zizzing tanned, happy people to work anywhere in the world. Digital beds, watches that won't melt, movies in hotels, ant-proof casters, lights that never go out. A cure for the shuffles, cheap art and compulsive education and all of this part. 61, the future, easy, efficient, affordable. It's a... What? My voice.
And Eric, I knew you'd say that. What about the smoke? What about the quartzman? What about reality?
No,
you cry for progress. I aim for ice cream.
That's
what about the inner people?
You mean the Kongs?
What about the rats?
And he had in mind, obviously, people like Mao, Hitler, Stalin, but what he was really saying is that, you know, the world rolls on. And what we really have an obligation to do, ultimately, is to at least bear witness to what's unfolding. And that gave me a very strong sense of almost detachment, so that, you know, I never lose my energy, my idealism, because I never expect to win. You know, my father was very good in that. He wasn't really a Christian man, but he always would say, you know, there's just two choices. You know, you're going to be on the side of good or evil, and take your pick. And if you realize you're not going to win, you just have to keep pushing, then you don't get disturbed necessarily, and you come to recognize pessimism is just an indulgence. And so when you look at sort of the range of things that I spoke about in that book, the answer to your question, David, is sort of, in a sense, the obvious. Some things got better and some things got worse. I spoke, for example, in the Massey lectures of this extraordinary nomadic people in the forests of Southeast Asia, the Penan, the last nomads of Southeast Asia in Borneo. And when I was with them, I mean, it was extraordinary. You know, nomadic peoples are profoundly different. I mean, how do you measure wealth in a culture when there's no incentive whatsoever to accumulate material possessions? Well, in that culture, wealth was defined explicitly, the social relations between people, because if those fray, everybody suffers. In that society, there was no word for thank you, for everything was automatically shared. If you gave a cigarette to a little old woman, she would peel it apart to distribute the individual strands of tobacco equitably to every hut in the encampment, rendering the object useless, honoring her obligation to share.
Smokers, doesn't this sound familiar?
Hold it right there!
No, I think I'll hold it over here.
If I knew just what I had to say. Oh. I'm Nick Danger with another world of advice for you men. You know, here in the radio studio, it's all dinge and dinger, but when that on-the-air sign goes off, I'm just plain Ed Eagle, actor, Indian, and second-class citizen. You know where I come from, most folks like to pass around a pipe because the spirits in the air around us can get overloaded from the stress and strain that most of us working men call real life. So when I get home, I like to fill up my calabash with a fresh load of goat's head pipe tobacco. Light a match with my sharp thumbnail and enjoy one heck of a good smoke. It doesn't just blow the brimstone out of your brain, it appeases all those friendly spirits right on down the line.
So get with it, man. Buy a pouch today. And remember what the folks back on the reservation say.
Goat's head pipe tobacco, goat's head pipe tobacco, goat's head pipe tobacco, goat's head pipe.
Yes, it's devilishly good.
And we took to them.
And they took to us.
And what do you think they took?
Oil from Canada, gold from Mexico, geese from the neighbor's backyard, boom, boom. Corn from the Indians, tobacco from the Indians, Dakota from the Indians, New Jersey from the Indians, New Hampshire from the Indians, New England from the Indians, New Delhi from the Indians.
Indonesia for the Indonesians!
Yes, Veterans Day.
Well, that way of life, morally inspired, inherently right, with a perspicacious knowledge of the rainforest that would put any Harvard PhD biologist to shame in one generation that has been crushed along with the forest that gave it birth. It's sort of the nature of life, isn't it? I mean, if you go to Tibet, you know, when I wrote the Massey lectures, there was still this strong sense of a Tibetan culture. Now I just came back from Tibet on a recent expedition, and the sinification of Tibet is almost complete.
Radio Beijing.
It has been reported that the Tibetans have come to believe their Dalai Lama has been reborn on Mars. Perhaps Tibet isn't communist enough for the Dalai Lama. He has to go to a planet that's completely red. What hilarious things these Tibetans believe.
People of Tibet, you must worship us. Abandon your crumbling memory palaces. The only permanent reality comes from the barrel of a gun.
Om Mani Padme.
We'll atomize your temples and scatter the quarks of superstitions. Your kids will view you with cosmopolitan scorn.
I pledge allegiance to the prayer flag.
Tibetan culture's uncool. Your Dalai Lama's reborn a cartoon being. From Beijing Studios' brightest cartoonists.
3 million degrees and climbing.
Well, hell.
Oxygen, 0.53%.
Oh, Dolly.
My what? Tears melting.
What's it like on Mars, Dolly?
Bad. It's good to be back on planet Earth. Lots to eat here. Not just rocks to talk to. Dumb old sand. Bad. Bad. And his sidekick raccoon, Kundun.
Kundun, I saw you standing on Luna.
This is one small step for man.
You were grilling a tuna.
Don't get fresh with me, tuna. Where were you on the night of the murder? Stick him back in the can.
The returning Mars rover has just landed on Kundun.
You killed Kundun. You bastards.
Don't worry, Dolly. He'll be reborn in time for next week's show and get eaten by a giant worm.
Don't get shaitan with me, worm. Where were you on the night of the...
You know, but I think it's very important for young people. The worst thing that an older person can say to a young person is, boy, it used to be wonderful, you missed it. I mean, what a horrible thing to say, especially since we're responsible for all the awful things that they're inheriting, you know. And I think it's so important to say to young people that life isn't black and white, that it's an ongoing struggle between righteousness and deceit, or however you want, whatever language you want to use. And you just have to be on, make a choice what side you're going to be on, and then you just keep going. And it's amazing. People wonder how at 65 I can still be so energetic and still writing these books and doing these expeditions and still singing the songs of culture around the world. Well, it's because it's just what I do, you know. I'm not trying to win. I grew up, as David mentioned, in Montreal at the time of the Two Solitudes, and I was in a kind of an English suburb that was sort of plunked like a carbuncle in the back of a very old Francophone village, and there was a boulevard, Cartier Boulevard, that divided the two, and my mom would send me to get cigarettes in the corner, and I would sit there with this old Francophone couple and peer across this boulevard to another world, another universe, another language, another religion, another way of being. And I became fascinated at the age of 5 by that. Like, why is that? And why can't I cross this road? And in a way, I've been crossing that road ever since.
Well, folks, here we are in Paris, land of the Eiffel Tower. A significant group of French students have gathered here under the beautiful Arc de Triomphe to protest the state of international youth. And I have with me the spokesman of the group.
I am Jean Turmoil, and I'm very happy to be able to talk to the world in this way.
Jean, could you tell the audience what is the nature of your protest today?
Well, for the first time, we are trying a technique borrowed from the American. Friends. It is the loving. There's not enough love in the world. There's not enough love between different political factions. There's not enough love between, for instance, the communist and the fascist in our society. There's not enough love between the older people, the younger people. There's not enough love between me and anybody. This is the only time I get to love anybody.
Well, what is different about the method and technique? I noticed that there's a very interesting scene going under here, under the picturesque Arc de Triomphe.
Yes, you notice, for the first time, it's not only the male students who are going to be beaten up. We have today both the co-educational and the female students. And you will notice that... Oh, excuse me, a moment. Hey, Michel, comment ça va? Michel, look, I'm... Je parle sur Ali maintenant, I can talk to you. Will you go lie down, please, I have to talk to you. Go lie down, Michel. Yes, I'm sorry.
You were saying that this love-in is different from your other protests.
Yes,
how is that?
Well, I would like to explain, first of all, that the gendarmes usually attack us with a leaden cloak, you know? So for the first time, we have put in leaden blankets and stopped the traffic pattern. You see, we have led them out here, and
I think the audience is really interested in knowing what is the political manifestation of this protest.
Yes, well, first of all, I want to make very clear, we are not the communists. We are not Michel, je ne peux pas. Je ne peux pas.
Where do you think, excuse me, Jean, just if I could just have a few minutes of your time, just where do you think the protest here is going to go in terms of international
youth? We want to go all the way to the top. We're going to the minister, Michel, please. Oh, oui?
Well, that's very interesting. If we could just have the minister.
But it's starting. I've got to get over there with Michel right now. A bientôt, babes. Michel, attends.
Allons, enfants de la patrie, le jeu de
and as the sun sets over the picturesque writhing bodies under the picturesque Arc de Triomphe, we bid a picturesque farewell to Paris.
Michel.
Historical land of love and lovers.
Michel, ma belle.
We had a teacher who had the kind of fey veneer of a dandy, trailed clouds of cologne, but all of that was betrayed by a glass eye and a scarred face that marked a body blown apart in the war. And he took 6 boys to Colombia one summer, and my mother worked as a secretary in an elementary school all year to afford for me to join that trip. And I was 14 and by far the youngest of the group, and by complete good fortune, whereas the other lads were billeted with very affluent families and spent most of the sweltering summer in the country clubs of Cali, I was with a family high up in the mountains on the trails that ran west to the Pacific. I never saw the Canadians all summer, and it was kind of a classic Colombian scene, multitudes of children, indulgent fathers, grandmothers who muttered to themselves on porches overlooking fruit trees and flower gardens, In 8 weeks, I encountered the decency and strangeness of a people charged with a kind of strange intensity and an incredible compassion for the fragility of life. And whereas many of the other Canadian boys, I later discovered, had gotten terrible, what the Colombians call mamitis, which is homesickness, I felt like I had finally found home. And I never wanted to come back. I mean, I kissed my first girl, got drunk for the first time. It was just extraordinary. And you know, you could be dancing with a girlfriend and then dancing 2 minutes later with her mother. And, like, that doesn't happen in Canada. So I became enchanted, and then I went back, and I became a botanist and an anthropologist, and I ended up becoming an acolyte of this legendary Amazonian explorer, Richard Evans Schultes, and in time I would write his biography, One River. And that book was translated by a beautiful Colombian poet, Nicolas Sesquan, and it came out 200 pages longer, which is interesting, and became more than a cult book. It became a map of dreams for two generations of young people who, because of the violence, couldn't travel in their own country. And, you know, we forget that if it weren't for cocaine, that 50-year war would never have happened.
Thank you, man. Thank you. And now, appearing tonight, For the second time before this distinguished crowd, excuse me, something got into my nose backstage apparently. Thank you. Still alive, after 20 years on the blacklist, Hollywood's Wonder Kid, the legendary George L. Tinebiter. Tirebiter!
Thank you, Bert, and thank you, Jack, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for the gift of recognition by today's nostalgic, well-dressed young people.
The cocaine inundation was so extraordinary that at one point the Medellin cartel was budgeting $1,000 a week just for elastic bands. In the last year before to wrap the money in. The last year before the Acuerdo in 2016, the FARC, by then a band of 3,000 bandidos, made $600 million with cocaine. And so if you gave me the Rosedale Boy Scout group and $600 million, I could terrorize all of Ontario. And that's exactly what was going on in Colombia. During all the war, where 220,000 people died, over 7 million internally displaced, over 5 million forced to flee the nation. I said to David before we came on, how would the Americans feel if Canadians had patterns of drug consumption and drug laws that forced 85 million Americans to flee from their homes? And yet during all of those years, there were never more than 200,000 combatants in a nation of 48 million. And so for the vast majority of Colombians, particularly rural Colombians, they were simply victims of the violence, a violence that was fueled exclusively by the international consumption of cocaine. And so during all those years, Colombia nevertheless managed to maintain civil society, maintain democracy, green its cities, create millions of acres of national parks, and seek proper restitution with indigenous people in a way unparalleled by any nation state. And now it's poised on the verge of an economic cultural revival unlike anything seen in Latin America, because two generations of kids are coming home. And they're coming home from Paris and London and Moscow and New York and Toronto with skill sets in every single endeavor, you know. And the peace process is precarious, and meanwhile, in a way that should be a banner of pride around the world, Colombia has dealt with the biggest humanitarian crisis in the history of South America. They've absorbed, educated, fed, housed, given medical care to 1.4 million Venezuelans. So Colombia does not deserve the clichés that have been wrapped so cruelly around it. They deserve all of our support as they seek to be reborn as the greatest democracy in Latin America.
No me gusta Buffalo Bill porque mata a los indios, pero qué buen corredor de caballo.
which roughly translates, I don't like Buffalo Bill because he killed the Indians, but he sure could ride a horse. And in there we have these 12 little cards. Now, these cards have to do, there are also postcards on the back, you can send them to your friends. But the real reason they're cards is so we can shuffle them up. The history of the American Indian is something I got involved with during the 60s, first doing a radio show of my own and then doing a show with Phil and Peter from the Fireside. We went out to the Hopi Reservation in northern Arizona one very cold winter day. As a matter of fact, it was for the winter solstice celebration, which is called the Soyal celebration. Snowy night, many, many miles from anywhere on three mesas overlooking a vast falling away of desert. You can see 75, 80 miles in the distance in every direction. The oldest constantly inhabited site in the United States, they say, is Old Oriabi, the village of Old Oriabi on the one of these three mesas. Been there, they can, I hear, find trash of human civilization on the surface of the ground just about that goes back a couple of thousand years. So they've been there for a long time, the Hopi have. Watching it come and go, watching it come and go. As I sat in my Volkswagen bus, we all had Volkswagen buses and old clothes in those days. I sat in my Volkswagen bus that night just at the time when the Kachinas came up out of the bowels of the earth to distribute the little feathers, which were the tokens of the new season coming along. Just at that time, and a mile or two away from the village, lying in the bus, I heard the music of the spheres, a great chime as if the whole dome of heaven had been struck. Can't explain it. Certainly weren't any PA systems out there. One of the most remarkable noises I've ever heard, sounds I've ever heard. Well, anyway, the history of the Indians, this is a look at it. And as I say, you can just shuffle up this history any way you want. It doesn't matter really where you start, because it always comes out the same. When you saw them, you knew how they moved, like bison or grass fire, slowly. The sum of those things you know is what they were beginning to forget, and I reach past what I know to remember them. When it was all gone, all of it, there was still a center. They never knew you kept it. They knew what they were doing, like dull birds scraping the sea in the short grass, but never wandering, always with death in their bellies. Some tried to make the land grow, but could not understand the way life came from it, and could not understand isolations and distances. So they came, with their names as baggage, their men's names forgotten, and you watched while the maps were drawn and the rain stopped falling. You, old man, after the last fight, you walked up to their eyes and spit their bullets out of your shirt. They knew what night was, but had forgotten about the stars, except mariners, and it's hard to change the sea much. They couldn't kill water like men. Some knew what to do with where they found themselves. They found its corners. Their eyes are eagles now. They move. You went running. Footprints in the grass, animals in the leaves. My mouth breaks against your language. They were coming. Rising, you speak. The understanding is not words, but split rocks and corn growing. They need to know which way the wind blows. To play the victim, they fought the battle first. You ran bravely. And just to show you how this always turns out the same, you know you have to shuffle a deck of cards 7 times to truly shuffle a deck of cards. Did you know that? It's a true fact, a true science fact that I've learned from my years in now dealing with the professional science writer. 7 shuffles. Of course, you have to get the cards in between each other to make that work. It's hard. But seeing as how you're in the mood up there on the mesa, you old man, after the last fight, you walked up to their eyes and spit their bullets out of your shirt. They knew what they were doing. Like dull birds scraping the sea in the short grass, but never wandering, always with death in their bellies. Oh, they knew what night was, but had forgotten about the stars, except mariners, and it's hard to change the sea much. They couldn't kill water like men. Some knew what to do with where they found themselves, found its corners. Their eyes are eagles now. They move. The sum of those things you know is what they were beginning to forget, and I reach past what I know to remember them. When it was all gone, all of it, there was still a center. They never knew you kept it. When you saw them, you knew how they moved, like bison or grass fire, slowly. So they came. With their names as baggage, their men's names forgotten, and you watched while maps were drawn, and the rain stopped falling. You went running, footprints in the grass, animals in the leaves. My mouth breaks against your language. They were coming. Rising, you speak. The understanding is not words, but split rocks and corn growing. They need to know which way the wind blows. To play the victim, they fought the battle first. You ran bravely. Some tried to make the land grow, but could not understand the way life came from it, and could not understand isolations and distances. Hope, he said.